Your Grace, the Archbishop of Canterbury, your Archbishop of Westminster, Minister, may I echo the Archbishop of Westminster's congratulations to you, Archbishop of Canterbury, for this splendid initiative, which obviously on behalf of the Jewish community, I want to give my fullest support. And as I have just heard these very powerful and moving speeches, I've decided on the spot, but then on the hoof is how we make policy in our office. Don't copy the example, but I will actually be scheduling the Sabbath before the Copenhagen conference as a special environmental Sabbath for all our synagogues, at which we will study the environmental ethic that we share and commit ourselves to practical programs of action. Friends, the environment obviously raises the most fundamental issues, the future of life on Earth, and our responsibility to the planet and to our grandchildren not yet born. It also reflects our commitment to God, whom we believe created life and asked us to honor it and to safeguard it. We believe as Jews, and obviously not only as Jews, that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, that we are merely trustees or guardians of the planet, but as God says in Leviticus 25, the earth shall not be, the land shall not be sown in perpetuity, for it is mine. Secondly, we believe, as in Genesis 2, that our task is within the garden, lo'ovda u'lishomra. God planted the first humans in the garden to serve it and to protect it. And those are religious imperatives that have bound us ever since. And thirdly, we believe, it in fact is a phenomenon of the Hebrew language, that the word for humanity, Adam, a human being, is essentially the same as the word for earth, Adama, because we are taken from the earth, and we therefore owe it a sense of kinship and responsibility. Let me add just one further insight, because this is an interesting one. there's this huge paradox in Genesis 1, which has bothered everyone who ever read it, because Genesis 1 says, you know, monotheism, there's only one God, and only one God created the universe. So the question arises, how come in verse 26, when God is about to create humanity, he says, let us make man? In who was he talking to? And unless he talks to himself, sometimes he must get the feeling he is only talking to himself. But to whom was God speaking at that moment? A 19th century commentator called Samson Raphael Hirsch gave, I think, a fascinating answer. He said, since the creation of human beings had huge implications for the rest of creation, the birds, the beasts, the marine life, plant life, that is why before God took the decision to create human beings, he consulted with the birds, the fish, the trees, and the plants. Shall we together create humanity? To which, of course, their reply was, yes, if. If he builds but doesn't destroy, if he enhances but doesn't exploit, if he acts truly as a guardian and not as the owner using and abusing the good things of earth. In other words, we believe our very existence as human beings comes wrapped up in environmental imperatives and ecological responsibility. And that is why, of course, the Bible then develops the program in the book of Leviticus, in the book of Deuteronomy, about the sabbatical year. There are limits to our exploitation of the land. The idea of Deuteronomy, that you don't destroy trees or forests in the course of warfare, and so on and so forth. These are the world's first ecological imperatives, dating from 33 centuries ago, and that, of course, is something that Jews and Christians and others and Muslims share. The great Harvard biologist E.O. Wilson published a book in 2000. I mean, E.O. Wilson, the inventor of sociobiology and consilience, published a book in 2007 called Creation, subtitled An Appeal to Save Life on Earth. I thought that was a very good book, because E.O. Wilson is known not to be religious, but what this book was a call to religious people and to scientists to call off the war between religion and science and work together for the sake of the future of life on Earth. And I felt that was a very generous and appropriate call by a non-religious scientist. And I repeat, Archbishop, that I think your gathering, this gathering here today, is part of the response to that call. Well, let me just add three very simple points. Number one, as you know, many people believe, or at least some people believe, that God is an old man with a long white beard whose name is Darwin. Now, I think thanks to Darwin and an Augustinian monk called Gregor Mendel and Francis Crick and John Watson, the discoverers of DNA, and a man who began as an atheist, became a sincere Christian believer, Francis Collins, who headed up the Human Genome Project, we now have made, through Darwin, through genetics and the mapping of the genome, we have made a momentous discovery that must speak to us regardless of our faith commitments, namely that all life, from the most primitive bacterium to the angriest atheist, has one single source. All of life, in its diversity, comes written in the same language, the genetic code, and all comes from the same original source, the prokaryotic bacterium. We are indeed, as John Donne said, all pages, books in God's library. And that is a fundamentally religious idea, that unity up there creates diversity down here, and that all life is written in the language of God, those four letters of the genetic code. So the first thing is that science and religion, despite their apparent friction, actually converge on a profoundly scientific and at the same time religious idea that there is a kinship of life and hence a covenant of life, which we must honor. Secondly, crisis can sometimes be useful. There is a Chinese ideogram for crisis. As you probably know, the Chinese ideogram for crisis also means opportunity. In fact, the Hebrew language I like very much, because the Hebrew language word for crisis is mashber, which means mashber was originally the stool on which midwives sat to help women deliver babies. So in Hebrew, crisis means birth pangs. Crisis is not just an opportunity for something new. It is actually a sign that something new is being born. And I think that is where we are now. The environmental crisis has some very, very good news for us if we can respond together. We know, all of us, the great messianic vision of Isaiah chapter 11, that day when the lion and the lamb will live together. It's a utopian vision. It hasn't happened yet. Although apparently there is a zoo in Los Angeles where the lion and the lamb do live together, and a visitor to the zoo asked the zookeeper, "How do you manage that? Lion and a lamb living together?" The zookeeper replied, "It's easy. You just need a new lamb every day." Now, the interesting thing is that if the Bible is correct, there was one time when the lion and the lamb did live together. And that was, of course, in Noah's ark. How come they lived together in the ark? And the answer was, because if they didn't, they would drown. And that is what crisis does. It forces us together. And if we don't, we will all drown. And that is why I think we must act. Certainly we as religious individuals know this enormous paradox that the 21st century has reminded us of something we'd forgotten altogether, that the great world's faiths are the great world's great global institutions. We do, as Jews, Christians, Muslims, what everyone says, we should do in the 21st century. We think global, act local. We are global communities, but we have strong local communities which actually give us the power to do something about it. And suddenly, certain religious commands that got lost suddenly seem to be relevant again. What about the Sabbath? When did we deregulate Sunday? Do you remember Sunday? It used to be the time when the streets were quiet and when there was no shopping and no buying and no spending. And families used to eat together. They stopped eating together and they stopped living together as a result. Just work out, this is a Jewish Sabbath. You're not allowed to drive a car. You're not allowed to go in a plane. You're not allowed to switch on electricity. If the whole world kept Sabbath, we would solve the environmental crisis. How likely is it? I'm honestly not sure. But at any rate, what religions allow us to do is to take these big ideas and translate them into daily rituals, daily and weekly rituals. And that's what we have to do. We actually have to create a new set of rituals that recognize the importance of not just, in general, supporting the environment, but doing things in our lives that make a difference. And finally, of course, as Vincent so eloquently said, we come together, and in this, religious and non-religious alike, in the powerful concept of hope. We should not think this situation is hopeless, because it isn't. I once did a television program with Bob Geldof, who has been a personal leader in many of these areas. And I kind of wanted to see whether there was an element of faith behind all he does. Now, as you know, Bob Geldof is an amazing man and a wonderful man. But what he does for a living is that he's angry. So if you try and get Bob to say something religious or, it's quite difficult. So I asked him why he first got involved in fighting famine in Ethiopia. He said, "I was angry." "Ah," I said, "you mean sacred discontent." He said, "nothing sacred in it at all. It was just plain discontent." And I just kept trying and trying, and we filmed for an hour, and I didn't get anywhere, and he was just getting up. And I said, "try the last question," and his mask slipped. I said, "Bob, out there, a 12-year-old, 13-year-old kid is going to watch this program, and they may be the next Bob Geldof. What are you going to say to them to encourage them to be the next Bob Geldof?" And he did something so unexpected and so beautiful, I loved it, and we did catch it for television. He said, "I would quote Tennyson. And I would quote the lines, 'Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world.'" That is our shared faith, that it is never too late. We have many faiths, but only one world in which to live together. For God's sake and for ours, let us act together to save the future of that world. Thank you very much indeed.
Jonathan, thank you very much indeed for a wonderful vision of two things in particular. I think one was this sense of the interconnectedness of life, which in different ways has come through everything we've heard, and which certainly belongs in every religious tradition represented here. The other was the reminder of this as a crucial opportunity for religion and science to work constructively together and appreciate the best in one another for the sake of the world we both inhabit. I was reminded, though, with your interpretative allusion about Genesis, to the Quranic text about the angels' view of God's plan to create humanity, which is basically, "are you sure this is a good idea?" And I suspect that's something which many of us will have pondered, theologically and otherwise. Jonathan, thank you, and thanks to all our speakers.